Welcome to the iCoder Podcast with Ian McDuff.
Okay, hello once again, podcast and ODR audience, and welcome to this iCoder Podcast. I am Ian McDuff and your host for the series, and speaking with you from Wellington and Aotearoa, New Zealand. May I take this chance to wish you and yours, and indeed the planet, all the very best for 2024, knowing many of the challenges that we will face. In this conversation, I'm delighted to be joined by my friend and colleague, Dr. Sanjana Hattatua, who's been at the heart of the ODR world and digital technology for more than two decades. I think I came across your work first in 2004 when you were still at University of Queensland. And Sanjana is back home in Sri Lanka. Sanjana has recently returned to Sri Lanka after several years in New Zealand, where he completed his doctorate at Otago University with a thesis on liking hate. What a hell of a topic. Liking hate, social media, politics and conflict in Sri Lanka. That sounds like a fun read. And more recently, Sanjana has been research director with the Disinformation Project and remains in that position while back in Sri Lanka. Since 2001, Sanjana has been at the forefront of pioneering the integration of technology into peacebuilding initiatives. In 2007, he founded and continued to curate until June 2020, the award-winning Ground Views, which we'll talk about shortly, Sri Lanka's first citizen journalism website, which I strongly recommend listeners you have a look at. His expertise extends beyond Sri Lanka and South Asia, across five continents for over two decades in the fields of civic media, information, disinformation, new media literacy, web activism, digital security, and online advocacy. And if you could see the picture of Sanjana that I can see now, he's far too young to have achieved all of that. Either that or you're on some special medication. Since 2006, Sanjana has been special advisor to the ICT for Peace Foundation, with a focus on providing strategic insights and guidance in the deployment of ICTs for the intricate facets of crisis, early warning, prevention, management, and recovery. From 2002 to 2020, he was senior researcher at the Center for Policy Alternatives with a focus on secure strategies for online and mobile communication. And what I will do is this information and other I will put up on the web link for the podcast. Suffice to say, I think there are a few who've got the frontline, actually conflict frontline experience in devising and managing digital communication, security, citizen journalism, election monitoring, education, and information in a world of conflict than Sanjana. So welcome, Sanjana, and thank you for taking the time to join this podcast series.
Yeah, right, and hey, good to be with you,
Yeah. Look, there's a whole range of things to we can talk about, but I want to start with a slight provocation. In 1997, Francis Cairncross wrote a book which you may have read, The Death of Distance. And in that book, she said that the internet will, I quote, increase understanding, foster tolerance, and ultimately promote worldwide peace. How's that going?
Well, at the time that the book was written, I recall I certainly, and I would imagine not an insignificant number who are listening in, were on GeoCities.
Yes.
And marveling at quiche 3D animated GIFs of cats and text. Connecting to a global community that for somebody from Sri Lanka, dialing up to the web on a 28.8 kbps, kilobits per second modem, the mere reference to which may befuddle those younger listening in, was an incredible pathway and window to a world that was hitherto only available through the imagination of perhaps reading Enid Blyton or a Western author, in that it really gave this incredible perspective of similar youth, similar individuals in different countries. And it was a really global community that one connected to. And I think that that was perhaps for me, and I can't extrapolate from the personal to the general, but certainly for me, the zenith of what you just said as a provocation, it really was the erasure of distance. It really was a sense of community that was bound together by shared interests, by this willingness to share. And there was none of what I studied today, not just defining the conversation, but even parenthetically on the hinterlands of that discourse. There was no hate. There was no racism. There was no far right. There may have been misogyny and gendered harms, but I certainly didn't encounter it as a cisgender male. I wouldn't know. So I can't definitively say that they didn't exist, but they certainly didn't exist to the degree that is so visible and present and front and center today. And so I think that the simple answer to that is that it certainly hasn't, to me, stood the test of time. There are, of course, a number of reasons for that. And a great violence to everything else. And I think that, you know, the specific affordances like the like button, like what Facebook and Meta have introduced to their product and platform surfaces, to their apps, algorithms, and what we consider to be social media today, has contributed to the evisceration of that larger social cohesion online that that quote referred to, and certainly was present, you know, at the time of GeoCities and maybe AOL and what have you back in the day.
Yeah, I mean, it has to be said in her defense in the 2001 edition of that book that that expression had been removed.
So well, I mean, I think it was quite evident even then in the United States how things were going, though I think it really took, at least in the Global South, the advent of the mobile phone, the smartphones, to really both accelerate the process of adaptation and adoption of tech, but also because I think we simply didn't think of these things as robustly as we could have and should have, all of the deleterious effects on society as a consequence of that greater usage.
Yeah. And I guess you're, as a kind of follow-up, and we needn't dwell on this, if you recall in 2018 in the New York Magazine, a number of the founders of the internet, Jaron Lanier and others, wrote an apology for the internet. basically say, sorry, oops, wasn't meant to be like that.
No, 100%, I think. And, you know, there's a Netflix documentaries about some of the people who are behind the tech of the like button, the like functionality. Because it may surprise some people that when I first started using Facebook, there was no like button. There were no reactions. Right. There was nothing of what you would consider to be, a given on Meta's, at least Facebook, and certainly on things like Instagram as well. And so they, you know, with folks who did the YouTube algorithm in the first instance to, you know, to give you more and more and more and more of what it thought that you were interested in. I mean, the, you know, there are these individuals who have now completely switched tracks and, you know, that's a different discussion altogether, but it's at least it's nice to see them reflect now on what they have unleashed and what it has resulted in and now say, hey, we regret this. We are sorry about it. And now we are dedicating our lives to kind of fixing it.
Which is, in a way, been the work of, you know, one of the founders, Tim Berners-Lee, who's now behind developing the new internet. But And which I look forward to catching up with. In a way, that was a bit of an aside there, but it's always good to hear your opinions on these things. Can I go back a couple of decades with you, though, Sanjana, which is your really founding work with Ground Views, and I will put the link to Ground Views on the podcast website, because I really do encourage listeners to go and look at that, because it is an extraordinary website of citizen journalism. How did you get into that? Now, you set that up shortly after the cessation of hostilities in Sri Lanka, was that?
No,
was
not still, at all. Still going? Well, so Sri Lanka has endured a nearly 30-year-old brutal internecine civil war that occupied the entirety of my life, actually. So, you know, give you know, the dates of which any of this started are contestable, but approximate reason for the start of the war happened on in the year of my birth in 1977, and then it led to what is better known as the Tamil pogrom of July 1983, which was my first memory here. And I won't speak of that memory because I'm conscious that that level of violence is still unimaginable to what may be the listenership of this podcast. But I will say that I've written about it, and it was a it wasn't a pleasant memory when in my adult life I can process it. But as a 5 year old or 6 year old walking back home from school, as there was literally fire all around us, it was something that didn't compute, you know, and the horror of it was only later on. That led to various phases of war that engulfed the entire country, but the war itself was in the north of Sri Lanka. And in 2002, there was a ceasefire process, which I think is what you were hinting at, called the ceasefire agreement. And that lasted from late 2001 to 2005 and 2005's presidential election. And it then very quickly unraveled.
Yep.
And I set up Ground Views in 2006 or seven, late six, early seven, when we didn't know at the time that the war would reach its denouement in May 2009. But I set it up to bear witness to what the media in Sri Lanka at the time could not and would not report on.
Yeah. Am I right in recalling that part of the high tech you were using was using ordinary civilians on bicycles with mobile phones?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know this because we've been in touch, as you said, in your kind introduction for over two decades. At the time, our part of the world and Sri Lanka were ahead of the West and the rest in its adoption of telephony. In particular, the first generation of phones that had data. We're beyond SMS, 1G,
exciting stuff.
Exciting stuff, the Nokias and all the rest of it, which, you could do, basic video and, grainy stuff. But, it still allowed for a measure of bearing witness that simply wasn't there prior to the advent of that tech. And so we really embrace that. And the long and short of it is that, Ian, it's not a technological story, even though I emphasize the tech, it's actually a very human story.
Yeah.
We all need to tell stories. And the people who were at the front lines of heinous violence had stories to tell and now a means of recording those stories. Mm. And at the end of it, it was for accountability, it was for posterity, it was to deal with maybe guilt and sadness and loss. So it was a number of reasons for those stories to be told, but we thought, hey, let's create a platform for those stories to be told. And the point about this, Ian, is that, as you can imagine, in an autocratic country or state or government where there is a significant democratic deficit, stories are inconvenient.
Indeed.
Stories that, as Chimamanda Achebe said, that contest the single narrative are inconvenient.
Yep.
And they are more inconvenient than an armed revolution. Stories have life. Stories migrate. Stories can't be killed. Humans can be killed. Stories are intergenerational. Stories are communal. Stories are in the language of the vernacular. And so the government really didn't take too kindly to citizen journalism, as you can imagine. But it is precisely because of that that I wanted a fuller, richer, more complete record. Not the truth with the capital T, but something that was a fuller record and told from the perspectives of those who knew it best from the ground and for history, really. And so that now today, you know, decades hence, is a collection of stories that really doesn't exist anywhere else in the country, quite literally. But there's nothing else that captures, as I said, that consequential couple of years, like what we have archived now on Ground News. And just so that, you know, listeners should know, there was an equivalent of Ground News in Sinhala and Tamil as well, which started off in 2007.
And those, all three languages are still running?
Oh, yeah, 100%. Oh,
yeah, because I obviously was only able to look at the the English language version. But because I'm aware of the workshops we run on occasion in Sri Lanka, there was always the other, you know, Sinhalese and Tamil were always there, which is kind of a... It's not just a courtesy, it's absolutely essential.
Yeah, that's 100%. Yeah, 100%. English is widely spoken, but if you want to shape minds, shape perceptions, and communicate with the majority in the country, Sinhala is where it's at. And then, of course, again, going into the history of the country, I was never taught Tamil growing up, because I am Sinhalese. And Tamils need Sinhala to survive, but Sinhalese don't need to learn Tamil. And so there is this incredible gap of people who are geographically proximate. We are a universe apart, even though we are just a few dozen or 100 kilometers apart. And it's horrible. It's really sad. And then they changed the education system so that my sister's kids, my niece and nephew, now far more Tamil than I ever will. And I, you know, I mean, I hope that in the generations to come, that will kind of build a bridge. But that is also why we kind of focused on Sinhala and Tamil, because it's so fundamentally important. The English is important because it speaks to an international audience. And obviously, you know, it communicates to a different audience. But we really wanted to communicate what the Tamils in the north were also going through, so that that human connection of shared loss, of grief, and also of joy and expectation and aspiration and dreams and hopes, you know, could build some sort of a bond between communities who are otherwise demonizing each other all the time.
Yeah. I mean, it's tempting, because I've always been so fascinated with the history of Sri Lanka. And I gather I was first there when I was three.
How incredible. Yeah.
Apparently, there's a photograph of me at age three standing in front of the Goldface Hotel. We were on
our
way.
Go. Wouldn't have changed much.
I don't think it has. Right? Probably still the same owner is there. But just being intrigued by what you're talking about with language, and we can't really sort of segue into this as a separate topic. But language, as I understood it, was also at the heart of the start of the conflict with the... with the role of the Tamil population and government, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, language at the heart of it. I recall also some of the participants in our workshops who commented on the fact that they were Sinhalese but had Tamil names.
So it's complicated.
It's complicated. Yeah. And when you get stopped at a road stop and you give your name, and it's a Tamil name, but you're not. And one of our dear friends particularly think of she's Catholic Tamil, Catholic Sinhalese with the Tamil name.
Yeah.
And so it's, as you say, it's complicated. But so Ground Views really is a platform. Who has access to authorship? Who gets to write on that platform?
But anyone? Really. Anyone. Oh, we have the country's first guidelines for what we will accept. They were sui generis at the time and remain quite unique. And actually, the World Editors Forum leaned on us as a model for how, back in the day, this is going back a decade or so, how online moderation could occur.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, to cut a long story short, it's accessible. You could go to the site. It's all up there. And it was, you know, replicated in Sinhala and Tamil. You know, in a sense, what I wanted was, I was opposed to the human rights violations conducted by the government, and by, in particular, one family, the Rajapaksas.
Still there.
They still live, and they led to the ruination of the country in 2022. But I did not want the language they and their proxies used against us to be how the site would fight them and hold them accountable. So there was no bitter invective. There was no personal invective. There was nothing defamatory. And within those parameters, anything went. And I was told apocryphally and anecdotally that that is one reason why when a lot of other sites and a lot of other people behind sites were shut down, abducted or killed or threatened, Ground Views was allowed. It was given permission. And it was in the Hansard and elsewhere at the UN even heralded as, if you have Ground Views, what's the problem with freedom of expression? You know, as if this was the kind of, exemplar of what Sri Lanka was. So I think that that framework really helped maintain a certain tone and standard. And, you know, there was pushback here. Like, you know, it's like, how could you, you know, and it was legitimate, right? There were people who were very angry, right? I mean, these are people who have suffered great loss and all they knew was, to communicate this was in expletives. So it was always a hard, it was not, expletives were, poetic, for example, in poems and all the rest of it. Yeah. So it wasn't a carte blanche, no to cuss words or, bad language, quote unquote. But it was, prima facie, it was, very, very much a framework that said, hey, there needs to be some sort of decorum in how we address the problems that we share. Otherwise, we are no different to who we are fighting against.
Intriguing. Well, again, we'll put the link up because I really do encourage people to go and look at that site as a model of that kind of communication in and after. Well, can we optimistically say it's after the Civil War? Peace hasn't really arrived, has it?
No.
Not really.
No.
But that aside, do encourage people to go and look at the website. But what I want to do is to move to one other area of your work. Well, two others, but one to start with. Which I mentioned in the intro, which is ICT for Peace, which is Geneva-based, is that right?
Yes, yes.
Geneva-based. So can you say a bit about who ICT for Peace are, what their mission is, what your role is, the role of digital technologies and peace building, conflict prevention, et cetera?
Well, the foundation is Swiss-based and registered in Geneva, and I joined it in 2006, a couple of years after it was established, as part of following from the World Summit on Information Society, paragraph 36, which is a long paragraph, and typically, as these UN paragraphs go, it's just one run-on sentence. Yep. But essentially, what it means is that ICTs, information communications technologies, are integral to peace building, and that's all it really is, really. And it says that technologies need to be used and purposed for the pursuit of peace. And the foundation was a bit dormant when I joined it. And I joined it because I was invited to join it because of the work that I was doing in Sri Lanka using smartphones and tech and computers and the web at the time. Social media wasn't invented when I joined the foundation. With a view to furthering the stuff that we talked about in the ODR forums in Melbourne, and it was really a platform for ideas globally and in Europe as well, to see how ICTs could be intentionally used for conflict transformation. At the time, it was widely understood that technology was integral to war. And violence, that was a given, not just with the genesis of the internet from DARPA, but, a lot of other things that were being, talked about even at the time. The foundation was really interested in seeing how we could amplify and support the work that I was doing on the ground here and also using that experience to kind of extrapolate and maybe theorize around applicability in other countries and contexts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when you, I mean, this is probably going to be a naive question, but maybe it's a helpfully naive question. When you talk of using ICTs for peace and conflict mitigation, peace building, what sort of platforms, what sort of technology, and who has access to using that technology? Because access in the civilian field is also a major issue, perhaps all the more so in the international conflict field. But what platforms are we talking about, and an example or two?
Well, it was platform agnostic to the degree that everything from what's called COTS, commercially off-the-shelf software, through to open source FOSS, so free and open source software, through to a combination of those two models, through to my least favorite model, which was custom builds of certain platforms, be it bulletin boards or, you know, web forums or what have you, were encouraged. But in particular, Ian, and this is kind of the connection to ODR, as part of the Sri Lankan ceasefire agreement's support structure, there was a process called the One Text process that was architected by a South African called Hannes Siebert, who in turn was influential in the rainbow transition from apartheid under Mandela through a constitutional state. And essentially sought to bring together the two factions, the government of Sri Lanka and the LTTE, to agree on a single text that would lay the foundation for whatever work that would they could build on in the future. The facilitation of that discussion was something I architected on a platform called Groove Networks, which is going to be, you know, completely alien to, well, you've heard of it, but it would be completely alien to many who listen today, because it was bought over by Microsoft and integrated into Microsoft Office. So the collaboration tools and technologies that you have today on MS Office started with the tech on Groove. And it was a asynchronous, secure platform, multilingual, multimedia, quite ahead of its time. There's a video of what I did at the time that we used for the specific purpose of peace negotiations and conflict negotiations. So it was looking at that kind of tech, but also more web-based tech. As I said, at the time, Ian, there was no smartphone.
Right.
There was no social media. There was no, you know, TikTok or Instagram or any of the things that are being now obviously used for, you know, the purposes of what we speak about. So it was really web-based, you know, bulletin board, a web forum, or, you know, citizen journalism with ground views as the template sort of ideas that we were looking at the time.
Just back a bit there with ground views. Is that hosted on a commercial platform, or is I think of things like WordPress or
So it's 100%. So it's running off WordPress. We were one of the first in the country to pioneer that. You know, to cut a long story short, it could not be hosted in Sri Lanka. Right. And it needed to be robust enough to accommodate what would be DDoS attacks. So I have an interest in cybersecurity, and I knew enough about the Sri Lankan state's responses to inconvenient truths to architect the site in a manner that was robust enough to accommodate what would be the attacks against it by the government or proxies or by a third party, which is indeterminable. So it's hosted commercially. It was you know, it's running on WordPress because it affords a robust technical architecture. And there are other things that we've done to strengthen it at the time and since against takedowns and disruptions.
All right. It's kind of constant vigilance, isn't it? It's just...
No, 100%, actually.
Well, and again, what I'll do is I'll put the link for ICT for Peace on the... note about this podcast. I'm just aware of the time. How are you going for time, incidentally? You're okay
I'm
for
fine for time.
10 minutes or so? You're good? Excellent, because I want to segue to another part of your interesting but somewhat miserable life, given the work you're doing on disinformation, the work you were doing in New Zealand, which has been absolutely essential to the follow-up to the massacre at the Christchurch mosques and the hideous disinformation that is still around about that. You mentioned before we came on air the barrage of abuse that Jacinda Ardern received and continues to receive, and all of those, it has to be said, particularly women of colour, who are at the epicentre of this villainy. One of the things you mentioned at the outset of your comments now on Sri Lanka, but also in an email to me, you talked about the kind of dark side of ICT. And you know, this is the stuff that you're doing with Ground Views, with ICT for Peace, is the promise. And then there's the other stuff. And God knows this must keep you awake at night. I'm not sure I have the stomach for it. But you talk about the democratic deficit and truth decay, epistemic fracture. What is it that is the predominant focus of your work still now that you're back in Sri Lanka because you can do this by remote control? What is it that you are doing in order to detect disinformation and to manage, to mitigate? Where's this taking us?
Well, that's a large question.
Take your time, sir.
No, I mean, all of the terms that you mentioned may be familiar, but to many may be unfamiliar. All they try to communicate is a fundamental issue. Wherever in the world we are today, around how concerted efforts by networks of individuals within a particular country, but also now transnationally connected, seamlessly every day and in increasingly strategic and sophisticated ways, are unraveling fundamentally meaning. Without meaning, Ian, this conversation becomes gibberish. There needs to be a shared understanding of what we are speaking about. There needs to be an understanding and comprehension of the language. And there needs to be a shared understanding around the meaning of the words we use. I am a humanities scholar. I'm not a technologist. I'm not a technical person. And that background assists greatly in the study of what I do today, which is to see at scale, great sophistication, increasing speed, the production of stories meant deliberately to undermine the way that we connect with each other and understand what is, the world as it is. It re-presents things like the COVID vaccine, things like and ideas like liberal democracy, specific things like gender and ideas like education. Specific things like people of color or persons of color and ideas like immigration into an either or and a violent othering of people who don't have the same worldview as you do. Perception is projected as prescription and perspective is completely eroded. To be different is to be Satan or an enemy. To view the world differently is projected as an existential threat, And the point about it is, Ian, if you see difference as an existential threat, and very often in New Zealand, as in a, you know, it's represented in a Christian framework with good and evil, right? It's a Manichaean struggle.
Yep.
You really can't talk with somebody to negotiate difference if you believe that person is out to kill you and your family. And that is as strange as it may sound, but perhaps to listeners who are, you know, somewhat aware of this domain, maybe not so much, that is where we are at today. Technology and social media and algorithms are exacerbating this, but it is also, Ian, a social problem, one in your country, mine, and many others, including the United States, that has festered and festered and festered for decades.
Mm-hmm.
And populist politicians have employed for their own parochial gain. And now technology is the greatest tool to instrumentalize all of what we are familiar with that has been employed over the past decades at greater scope, speed, and scale.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, that's what I'm looking at. It's stories. It's the narratives that are seeded and spread. It's the stories we tell ourselves. And, you know, at the in the first few minutes of the HBO series Chernobyl, which I, you know, hugely recommend listeners, if they can find it, please see it. It's an incredible, okay. It's an incredible series. Obviously it's about Chernobyl, but it's really about truth. It's really about propaganda. It's really about the inability of, at the time, the USSR to acknowledge what was going on and wrong, and how that translates in, at a human level. And in the first few minutes, I won't spoil it, so I won't give out any spoilers, but in the first few minutes, there's this incredible monologue, which is incredibly powerful, and the script of which is available online, which I've used in lectures, which speaks to the power of lies and how truth decay led to Chernobyl, which is, at the end of the day, a catastrophe compounded by and contributed to the inability of the technicians and the engineers and society in the USSR to acknowledge that something was bloody wrong. Something was going wrong. And when something did go wrong, to kind of try to contain that by lies and lies and lies and lies. And that's what we are facing today in advanced democracies like New Zealand, as much as countries with a democratic deficit like Sri Lanka. And, you know, when I was growing up, you know, countries we looked up to, perhaps now with the naivete of, Lady Liberty holding the torch and that being coterminous with democracy. Yeah. I mean, you take a look at the United States today and you wonder, you know, stop telling us about how we should govern ourselves. You guys need to look at your own country.
And we'll send, the election monitors.
Send monitors ourselves. Yeah. I mean, 100%. Yeah. So, I mean, that's kind of what I look at. And it is worrying. It is a large sphere. You call it a miserable life. I wouldn't call it a miserable life.
That was unkind.
No, but I know where you're coming from. But it is certainly an interesting life. I'll put it there.
Yeah. I mean, just as you make those comments, which is, I mean, you're wonderfully articulate in saying this, is which I love to sit back and listen. But if I think of my coming aware of politics in New Zealand, because I'm considerably more ancient than you are, New Zealand politics was run by a very particular kind of truth of the white male variety, which happily has been undone with a significant diversity of representation we have in politics. But that undoing of that single truth, which had to happen, has also manifested the kind of multiple truths, and we've unleashed both a very powerful tool for political cynicism and inquiry, as well as the capacity for people to deny, on the basis of little, if any, evidence at all, what it is that's going on. The COVID vaccine is the prime example. There's a chap who's just been sentenced to prison here in New Zealand for selling bleach.
Bleach, exactly right. And profiting from it. vastly profiting.
It's about over $100,000 a week. I was about to say a lovely example, an awful example of the manipulation of truth there. He denies that he's a human being.
Yes.
He is not a human entity. Oh, please. I mean, the tolerance level of some of our judges must be set to...
To be clear, he's a sovereign citizen who doesn't deny he's a human being, but believes he's a sovereign being. He's not a citizen of New Zealand. Yeah. He's a independent human.
Yeah.
And as funny and as ridiculous as it may sound, and it does sound funny and ridiculous, there is, as you know full well, Ian, a very dark side to this.
Oh, yes.
Which was manifest in his own behavior to the judge in court, where there's an abrasiveness and a violence and a complete rejection of the rule of law that in across the Tasman in Australia and certainly in Canada and the United States, has led to terrorism. Right.
Absolutely.
So this is one spectrum of this, one telos, as in they would say in Greek, is violence, is terrorism.
Sure. We're going to need to wind up in a minute or two, but I could continue. In fact, I'm bound to think I'm going to come back to you for further conversations because I'm enjoying this so much. But I just have one question to wind up, if I may. What keeps you optimistic?
There's so many good things about the world as it is that when you focus on what I do, your hope comes from the belief that by strengthening that good, the good in New Zealand are good people, are institutions that don't wish harm, can be strengthened in a manner that helps society escapes the worst of the path dependencies, the worst of the way things would evolve into if not otherwise addressed, which is my academic response. My other response is a very personal one. And it is, and I genuinely mean this, I came to New Zealand not expecting to do what I do today. And, I come from a home that's lost. I lost, Sri Lanka is lost. And home is lost, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a profound sadness that comes with that loss. And what keeps me doing the work that I do in New Zealand, which is extraordinarily hard, is that Sri Lankan or my generation, and with my experience, what we try to do now is to help where we can, others avoid the worst of what we ended up as. That's in Māori, in te reo Māori, that's our mahi, that's our calling.
Yeah.
And we give it our all, what we can't do at home but would love to, we find many of us around the world now, scattered in various domains and professions and countries and contexts, we find that we can help others understand, clarify, and shape structures and responses in a way that help them avoid what we became. And I say that because, where we are today, if I look back, 10 years, I can see how it evolved.
Yeah.
I can see how words have meaning. I can see how words are never words. I can see how what's online invariably results in offline consequence. And there's as academic questions and debates which are valuable and necessary, but those of us with lived experience know these things to be true. And that is then the belief, the experience, the sadness, but also the hope that fundamentally, for many of us, including myself, drive us in our work to do what we can to support those we work with so that they can build a better future for them and their grandchildren in their countries.
Sanjana, I can think of no better, more poignant note on which to finish. And I, and no doubt everyone who's listening to this, would wish you all the strength to do that. And it's, you know, as someone who, you know, I've been to Sri Lanka 6 or 8 times and absolutely love it, and have marvelled at the warmth and the strength of the people from all sides of the business there. And it must be heartbreaking, and I see this in you now, heartbreaking to say your country is lost. And thank you for the work that you're doing for the wider ICT digital community for Sri Lanka and for us down here in this part of the world. So we should wind up on that note, and all I can do is thank you from the bottom of my heart.
This podcast has been brought to you by ICODER, the International Council for Online Dispute Resolution. To learn more about ICODER or to become a supporting member, please visit our website at icodr.org.